Fun to be back. It's great to see what's going on here at Perimeter. It's really exciting. I thought that since this is the first talk of the conference, I would try to be a little controversial, and I thought if you come to the Perimeter Institute, right, the best way to be controversial is to talk about the landscape. So I thought that I would try and make sense of the direct detection situation. So I will tell you right now that I failed. The direct detection situation is a mess, and the talk is going to reflect that. So let's begin. The basic point that I want to discuss are these, that a whole bunch of experiments have data. We were all along talking about the era of data in direct detection experiments. And to leading order, nobody agrees with anybody else. This is both for positive experiments and negative experiments. So let's talk about that. Now, I think most people in this audience have a decent background in thinking about these sorts of things. But just to be clear, I want to review the basic ingredients. Now, the whole mess all started with DAMA. So let me go through what DAMA is and what the other experiments are. So DAMA, it's a sodium iodide crystal. It scintillates. It started at 100 kilograms, and it is upgraded to 250 kilograms. They look for an annual modulation as the Earth moves around the sun into and out of the WIMP wind that is expected to be there, and they see this modulation. So super. What's to like about this experiment? If I just said I found a modulation, then you would say, who cares? Lots of things modulate. It's a much better experiment than that. They have 24 separate crystals. They can see whether two of them fire simultaneously, throw those events out. The modulation is only in the single hit, so one crystal firing. So backgrounds would fire in multiple. They don't see modulation there. The phase appears to be stable. It's in the appropriate low energy region, not in the high energy region. And at the moment, there's no obvious conventional explanations. There are proposed conventional explanations, but none of them jump right out at you as being correct. What should you not like about this? Principally, the fact that it disagrees with the results from other experiments. But the data are also still unavailable. That's going to be a problem that we're going to encounter more and more. And they cannot tell you on an event-by-event basis whether it looks WIMP-like or background-like. They can just ask whether there are more in the summer than in the winter. And so this started the whole problem. And I should be clear, just as a warning to like Guillaume, I'm not going to go into all the experiments. I'm not going to go into the recent analysis. I'm just going to give a little perspective on some subset of them. So this also used to be very simple. You had DAMA. You had a few null results. And then you had a whole lot of models that attempted to reconcile them. And they fell into various categories. You had your sort of light WIMPs. They could interact in a variety of ways. You had your heavy WIMPs. Interacting in a variety of ways. And then you had your sort of like weird, strange, different types of WIMPs that would produce electromagnetic energy. And then along came Cogent. And let me just say that it is very relaxing to be able to give the first beginning discussion of Cogent before Juan has arrived. Juan is a great guy, but I only have 40 minutes. So this is Cogent. These are the data. Just to be clear, at least at the beginning, when we were introduced to this, you see these data. You see all these peaks. They are, of course, not the result that you are interested in. This is a zoom in on the low energy region. This spike here is not an interesting result. That is a background from an electron capture. It is this rise here. And you can see the sort of candidate fit at the time, given by the Cogent collaboration, was the 7 GeV WIMP that sort of fits this exponential rise at low energies. So the idea was you have all these events here, and those are too many to be explained by a known background, so that could be a WIMP. So what is it? It's an ionization experiment with a signal rate which is about 10 times larger than backgrounds, at least the proposed backgrounds at the time. So maybe it's dark matter. So what's to like about it? The energy resolution is outstanding. They really know the ionization extremely well. The calibration is good because you have known peaks at low energies that you can calibrate your experiment on. And excellent statistics, right? We're not talking about finding 5 events or 10 events. We're talking about finding hundreds of events, and the signal to background is large, at least in principle. What's not to like? You again can't discriminate. This experiment has not been mercilessly beaten for about a decade. So you know the kind of things that you find out as you really, really push the experiment. The modulation that has appeared, and Paddy will talk about this more in his talk, is not obviously, the modulation appears more to be in this range, while the signal appears to be in this range, the exponential signal appears to be in this range. And then, of course, the null results from other experiments. And then the last interloper into the field, making a mess of it, is CREST. So CREST is a calcium tungstate experiment. If you've not seen it, they have 8 different detectors that they're using in their final result. This is one such detector. The way they discriminate is that different types of backgrounds have different amounts of light. We don't have a CREST talk, so I'm going to spend a bit more time on CREST than I will on the other experiments. The way they discriminate is that if you could see up here, there's a whole lot of events that are all from electron recoils, from gamma backgrounds. But then, since it's made out of 3 different target materials, depending on which nucleus recoils, you get a different amount of light. So tungsten gives you the least amount of light. It's this sort of ugly band here. This magenta band is oxygen. This yellow band is not calcium. It's alphas, which is a background to your experiment. So anything in this yellow band is supposed to be alphas. And what they kind of said was, hey, look, we see all these events down here at low energies in the oxygen band, which is sort of what you would expect for a light WIMP. So what is it? It's an excess of events in a calcium tungstate detector, really 8 detectors, consistent with oxygen scattering, or so they say. What's it like? They have very good discrimination against their electronic backgrounds, which are up there, and they believe strongly it's not muon-induced neutrons because they open and close their detector and didn't see the flux change. What's not to like? A lot of their events, I'll go into more detail about this, are at high energies where they really should have shown up in other experiments. There are known backgrounds below it, sort of coming up on the right side of it. There's the alpha background above it. You have the gamma leakage to the left of it. And then there's also, in principle, a neutron background, which should really just look like an oxygen band. So here I said you have signals left, right, above, and below, but you also have signals in the or backgrounds in the signal region. So that's very difficult, right, to extract a signal from that background. We've also still only officially seen in their paper 2 of the 9 detectors. A third one I'll show that has sort of been shown at a conference as well. So the excitement in the first set of things that I want to discuss is the excitement that sort of pushed us in the direction of light WIMPs, right? So this is what made us very, very excited of late. The idea is very simple. Dhamma should be scattering through sodium. CREST should be scattering off of oxygen and, to some extent, calcium. And cogent should have low energy scattering on germanium. And so the basic picture is this. So this is a sigma mass plot that's very familiar. You have the WIMP cross-section per nucleon here, the WIMP mass along the x-axis, and you have the regions favored by the different experiments. So this yellow region here is what fits Dhamma's modulation. This magenta or purpley thing is the cogent fit to their own data. And then these 2 regions here are what CREST claims fit their data. So you have 2 islands. You have sort of a heavy mass island for CREST, and you have a light mass island for CREST. The light mass island does not have any regions that are within the 68% confidence, but they do have it within 95% confidence. So you look at this, and if you sort of stare at this region of the plot, then you say, well, you know, these things are all sort of within spitting distance. This is very exciting. Maybe these things are the same thing. Well, let's talk about that. But one thing that I really want to emphasize is that this space of this plot is not a metric space, right? You cannot look at 2 points which are close on this space and believe that they are actually close in some fundamental way, because signals can change radically from going from this place to this place, and we'll actually discuss how very, very different a signal here and a signal here can look. So one thing that you would like to ask about this new CREST result is what does it look like? And unfortunately, at the moment, we really don't know what it looks like completely. They have 8 detectors. Each detector has a different amount of backgrounds. These bands in each detector have different widths. The light leakage is different in different detectors, so they set the threshold different for different detectors. So the counts, thresholds, acceptances, all of that are going to be different for the different detectors. So here we only have 3 of them. These 2 were in the paper. This was shown at with the full data set at the German Physical Society meeting. So we've kind of seen 3 detectors at this point. So there are 4 that we haven't seen. So it's very, very hard if you are a theorist and you want to come and look at these data and say, what sense to make of this? It's very hard to come and actually come up with a picture because you don't actually know what you're trying to fit, right? If you look at the archive, there's not been the usual rush of papers of people trying to explain these data. And I think a big part of the reason is that nobody really knows what the data are they're trying to fit. So the best effort along these lines that has come out is this plot from the Oxford group, where they actually took the 2007 CREST data and did an analysis as to what kinds of limits, because the regions, the measurements of the quenching factors changed from one experiment to the other. You could redo the analysis, and they plotted that limit curve, and you can see that there is some tension. It's not an exclusion, but there is some tension between the old result and the new one. But something that I want to point out, and something that I think that if I can have one result in this talk, it would be to try to encourage people to press experimentalists as they see them about certain results, because one thing is it's not obvious to me, and I think it really needs to be cleared up as to whether or not this interpretation of the CREST result is consistent with itself. This is detector 5. This is the one that was not in the paper. This is the one that was presented at the German Physical Society. You should take it with a grain of salt, maybe a pound of salt, but let me just discuss it because this is what they showed. You have this oxygen acceptance region here, and you also have this tungsten region below. But what I'd want to point to you is that if you look in this region here, there are really very, very few points down here. And at least when I asked one of the PIs of the experiment about how their efficiencies were, he said they were fairly stable down to about 3 keV. Now, maybe that's not true anymore, but just let's pretend for a moment that their efficiencies are stable and ask, what should you see? If you take their central value point in their light mass region and calculate how many events are supposed to be here, above 5 keV in the lower half here, you would expect 28 events. Okay? If you go all the way down to 3 keV, so where I believe this green band starts, then you would expect 96 events just in the lower half. Okay? So there are a couple of possibilities. One is they just didn't put all the points on this plot. That's not impossible, right? Another possibility is that efficiencies are actually falling off very rapidly there, and that's what's solving this problem. But it is the reason why they choose their threshold at the very value they do has nothing to do with efficiencies. It has to do with light leakage. And so in principle, you can ask, this is a legitimate question to ask, is this interpretation consistent with what you see below? And of course, that could just, this extrapolation, the reason why you get so many events down here is because you're using this exponentially rising background from the velocity distribution. And if you're talking about some non-Maxwellian halo or something like that, there's no reason why you have to necessarily have 100 events down here. It could be a non-Maxwellian halo or something like this. But a question that we really need to know is this a self-consistent interpretation? Because they extract their ultimate results, what they call their excess, they extract by doing a fit to a standard WIMP. So if you know that it's not a standard WIMP, then you should not be able to extract a background doing that, or extract a signal doing that. If it's really this, it's hard because there's a signal to background question. I don't know how much of this is background. Some of it is background. But if, for instance, you wanted a uniform distribution, that would be a stream.
You can have a single stream.
A single stream would give you a uniform distribution. And then anything after that tends to start giving things that peak at low energy. So, what about Cogent? Cogent is also been evolving, and I was promising Lexi that I would say some things in my talk that I thought were probably wrong. So I'm about to do that, and I will explain to you what they are. But I think it's important because I think that even though this stuff has been out there for about 2 weeks now, not everybody is appreciating what's come out. So these are the Cogent data. You have this big peak. You can subtract it off because you think that these are known backgrounds. You can measure them at another energy, what the decay rates are, and then just subtract them. And you have this nice exponential curve. And one of the things that got very exciting was that there appeared to be some modulation in the Cogent data. Again, I'm going to leave this to Patty. You can look in the low energy 0 to 1.5 to AED range, which is sort of where the signal is. And there's not a very strong piece of evidence for modulation in that. There's some evidence for modulation down there, but it's not nearly as strong as if you look above 1.5. So if you look in this region, there's very, very strong evidence for modulation, much stronger than in low energy. And yet, that is in principle where the signal is supposed to be gone. So all this got very, very complicated when Juan gave his talk at Taup. And this is what I'm glad that he's not here so I can just say this, but I want to bring this up so that we can all be very sure to be completely prepared to hound Juan when he gets here. It is because these are the data here, right? And then maybe you know the answer to this, Guillaume, if my interpretation is correct. But you have these pink things here, right? Dash line, 12 GeV, blah, 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 crest-like. So this is something that they believe is crest-like, is this dash line here. Solid line, best WIMP fit from 2D energy time analysis. So that's if you actually take all their data and fit it, you get this. I believe this pink line is now supposed to be the signal. And then these pink dots, I believe, these are the best fit to bulk events. So if those are the bulk events, then those, I believe, are supposed to be the signal events. So my understanding, and this is what we need to make sure we get cleared up, because I think this plot got shown and people who were at Taup were not aware that this was potentially the interpretation, is that these are the signal events. This is now a background, which means that what we used to think was an order one, you know, really large signal to background is now a small signal to background. And of course, Juan says, or might say that, well, and he did say at Taup that, look, this is now in better agreement with CREST, but it certainly changes how you think about things, in particular because if you look at modulation, you can just count up these number of events, and it's hard to say because these are binned differently from these. So if you just count these up and treat them as counts, it looks like it's 50, but I think that counting is wrong. I think that's probably the binning is twice as large for these. So I think that you have about 100 events total in these pink circles up here, and if you take 100 events in these pink circles, then you get 0.74 counts per kilo, assuming that all these dots here modulate 100%. So they're on in the summer and off in the winter. Then you can get the measured amount of modulation. So basically, if you believe the modulation and you believe this, you are forced into a situation where you are 100% modulating. Okay? So if we are believing that, this is something we need to confront. But if that's the case, there's no way you can get a 100% modulation with a Maximilian halo. So then why are we doing all these comparisons and discussing things with a Maximilian halo and trying to extract fits to CREST using a Maximilian distribution? Yes?
True if it's inelastic?
Is that true? What?
Is that statement true if it's inelastic?
Let me defer some of that to Patty to discuss that. The best fit points that it's very hard to get a distribution that looks like this inelastically that has a lot of modulation up here. You could have something modulating up here. You could have two separate signals, possibly. We haven't redone the analysis with a light contribution and a heavy contribution, or, you know, an inelastic and an elastic contribution. But, I think fitting, if you want to fit this and fit this modulation simultaneously, that's going to probably be a little tough. Because inelastic models peak where the modulation is, and so if you think the modulation is here, then your total signal should really be peaking there. But maybe if you started doing things with halos, then you can probably get any spectrum you want. So this is just a plot of how things move that Juan showed. I'm not going to discuss this quenching factor issue, but it looks like there's a lot of motion going on, which just means that at the moment, nothing really overlaps. Modulation is way higher than expected. and simple extrapolation leads to conflict with null results. So if you just try to fit everything together in naive ways, none of it's really making sense. So if you had to ask me what's my prediction as to the next thing that's going to happen, I'm pretty sure that people are going to start invoking their own favorite Halo model. And the question you always want to ask is, what's going to happen to all this plot once you start invoking these different halos? So let me just take a moment to pitch one thing, which is that I think that we need to change a slightly different approach to comparing different experiments, right? If we really already are at the point where we're saying that you cannot explain these data with a Maxwellian halo, then we should stop using these sigma m plots to say whether or not an experiment is excluded or not excluded. We need different techniques to do this. And I think that this is an accident of the field, because you had a field that for a long time, the success of an experiment was defined in terms of how well it could consistently find nothing again and again, right? So you needed a really good way of quantifying nothing. And these sigma m plots were excellent ways of quantifying nothing. But now we have something, and that doesn't mean that these are the best ways to compare those results. So let's give up on trying to make these necessary measurements and really focus on this one question about comparing experiments and finding dark matter. So the technique is pretty straightforward. If you look at, say, pick your favorite model, I'm going to start with a spin-independent elastic scattering, which ironically is not my favorite model, but I'll start there anyway. The differential scattering rate is some prefactor times a cross-section which depends on energy in a known fashion, times some integral function, the integral of f of v, the distribution over v from v min to infinity. V min then depends on energy in this way. And so all of the energy dependence of this cross-section is in these two functions. That's known. And this is a simple kinematical question, right? So you can solve, if you know the energy, you know the v min. So there's a very, very simple idea that I think is what we should really start pushing towards when we're comparing these experiments, which is, suppose I have one experiment, cogent. It's got a signal in some energy range. So this is experiment one with a low energy and a high energy range. That doesn't map into a unique space in velocity space, because high inner velocities can always create low energy scattering. But if you think instead of in V-min space, right, where V-min is a point which is a set of particles, of all particles with velocity greater than that velocity, then there is a mapping. There is a mapping between the energy and V-min. So this energy range maps into some space in V-min. You can then, if you have a second experiment, you can also completely non-trivially map that V-min space back into the second experiment. And so now you know precisely where to compare experiments. So if you see a signal at one experiment in one range, you know exactly where you should look in the other experiment. So this is just an example as a function of WIMP mass for cogent, Dama, and Crest, where they find their signal appearing. And you can see that the V-min range that is probed is really only really overlapping at low energies. At high energies, these are, or at high masses, these are very disjoint. And these lines are different thresholds for xenon 1, 2, and 5 keV, and for silicon 7 and 10 keV. But the point is that xenon should be able to, for instance, robustly probe most of the crest region almost anywhere, because crest is always above xenon, but it's harder in a model-independent fashion to probe, say, the cogent region. The second element of the idea is this. You can use a technique that Patty pointed out to me is the magical power of algebra, which is our big accomplishment here. Which is to note that if you write the differential rate expression like this, you can actually multiply both sides of this equation by 1 over that. And if you do that, you now have an expression which is just for this integral function g of v. Well, if you know g of v, and I measure g of v at one experiment, I can then substitute it back into the experiment, so you can get this final expression here. So, for instance, with spin-independent scattering, if you have experiment 2, say, xenon, then you have differential rate at that experiment is some prefactor times the rate at the first experiment where you map the energy in the second experiment to the first experiment through this V-min mapping that we discussed just before. So schematically, it looks like this. if you extract the xenon or the cogent data, right? So these are some way of extracting the cogent data. This is the E recoiled cogent. This is the 1 over form factor times dr der, okay? I can then just put a completely analogous set of axes on the other side, the xenon E recoil and the xenon dr der on the y-axis. So the point is that these data points are completely unambiguous what they should do in another experiment. So I don't need to talk about halo models. I can really just say, what does this signal here look like in that experiment there under the assumption of a given particle physics model? However, I don't know what the current data are. So I am not going to do this mapping for you today. What about CREST? CREST I feel a little bit more comfortable doing because I didn't know the data before and I don't know the data now. So CREST has a number of different detectors. They have very, very, very different thresholds. But something to note is that a lot of these detectors have thresholds that are above 15 keV, and we've actually seen 3, 5, 20, and 51 of the detectors that have low thresholds, so you can actually look and see how many events are there at low energy. So basically, if here's the distribution of events here that they tell us are there, you can see that at 15 keV, a really large fraction of your events are at high energy. So something that we did with the preliminary data, and again, we'll repeat once we have the final data, is to take the excess that they were claiming in the 500 kilogram days and map it into, say, xenon or or to CDMS silicon. And you always pretty much find that if you have, say, a 10 GeV experiment and you just take the number of events that you saw at CREST, then you, generally speaking, should have had a lot of events at xenon and a lot of events at CDMS silicon as well. Which means that if you really want to just understand this population of events, if you think that there's some sizable background up here, it naively looks like you just cannot accommodate that with these other experiments. So let me just be a little clear. I can break up the data. Don't worry about the second lines. The top line is the energy. So this is an energy bin, energy bin, energy bin, energy bin. Ignore the bottom line. This is what the mapped into energy range would be at different targets. And so naively, you have sort of two ranges. You have the cogent signal range, which is in the lowest two bins from 0.5 to 1.5. Then you have the cogent modulation slash CREST signal range, which is about 1.5 to 3.1. And this is the range here, which really should easily be probed by other experiments. But if you really want to do the xenon 100 analysis, I can't do that yet because I don't know how to include your S2 efficiencies at low energy. So this is something that we need from the xenon collaboration, is to give us some way of doing that kind of a map. So the summary of the light WIMPs is pretty straightforward. Even if you abandon halo model constraints, I at the moment don't know how to fit everything together unless you start introducing something that also injects some amount of electronic energy into the system to avoid, like, xenon. So let me sidle on to the second question, which I actually think is something which is not really appreciated at the moment, but I think is still interesting. Because remember, we're no longer talking about what explanation explains all the data. Right now we're talking about what explanations have the least conflict with the total set of data. So let me move on to heavy WIMPs for Dhamma. Let me take for a moment this idea that Dhamma is explained by the scattering off of iodine. We know about inelastic dark matter, resonant dark matter, but it could just be that we are not super clever, right? And maybe there's some other model out there that we just haven't thought of that somehow is really picking out iodine. So let's start with that question and ask, what do we know about just scattering off of iodine? And try to speak in a model-independent fashion about that. So there are two results, or I should say, what are the results that we want to discuss? Kim's and Ku both have iodine in them, which means that you have to really look at those results. Xenon 100 has xenon, which at least if you're talking about kinematics is going to be similar. And of course, CREST is tungsten, but it is related at least in inelastic models. So let's start with Kim's. Kim's recently put out results. They have backgrounds which are gamma backgrounds, surface alphas, and then in principle dark matter. And they have different pulse times. So this is the distribution of pulse times for their gamma background. This green is the distribution of pulse times for surface alphas, and this blue is the distribution of times for nuclear recoils or signal. The problem with this is, if you look at their data, there appears to be a non-Gaussian tail, which is automatically going to pull additional surface alphas into your fit. So this appears to me, I mean, I think it's a very, very nice experiment, but this appears to me to be a way to extract limits from an experiment, but you have not calibrated this. It is not obvious to me that if I inserted a nuclear recoil signal to this that I would find it, because I can't even fit this signal with the background templates they have. So I don't know if that's pulling me to the side to get this sort of a limit. That said, I can go ahead and talk about what sorts of rates I would expect at Kim. So I can just take the Dhamma modulation and overlay it with what they say their 90% limits are. These black lines are what they say their 90% upper limits are. I personally would say you should take those 90% limits at the moment, not completely 100%. But it's certainly possible that if you just take a model-independent mapping, I take the Dhamma modulation and I map it into Kim, that I can be under their rates. So it appears to me that this is still allowed. But it requires really order one modulation, like really 100% modulation, if you believe their limits. What about Ku? Ku also has iodine. They had a run, a second run, at a 15 keV threshold, which is sensitive to the same region of parameter space that Dhamma is, for about 400 kilogram days. And what did they see? They saw a count rate of about 0.26 counts per day per kilogram. With about 390 days, that ends up being about 10 events, which gives you a 90% upper limit of about 0.04 counts per day per kilogram. Dhamma has iodine, so I can just ask what they should see, again, just mapping the modulation into this other experiment, and you would expect 0.036 if the efficiency is 100%, 0.031 if I use the 87% efficiency number that they discussed at Taup. So this rate that they are seeing is still consistent also. So if you just worry about iodine, then everything is requires a very, very large modulation, but it's still conceivably possible. So if you can come up with some model that scatters off iodine, you're in great shape. What about xenon? Well, Guillaume will talk about this, but I want to make just one very, very simple point. Everybody likes to talk on this axis, which is the nuclear recoil axis. But really, the data are in this axis, S1, the number of photoelectrons, right? Signal in light, in the scintillation light. Now, I don't know who this Planck guy is, but he made this measurement of L effective, and this blue band is what xenon uses, but this black dot is what Planck et al. Found. So this plot to me is basically saying that I should not trust that guy, okay, whoever he is. But I don't feel like that. I think he's a great guy, and I think that we should actually take him seriously. So what happens if you actually take the xenon 100 measurements of their L effective seriously? If I just take that central value, all these things are high. Why do I necessarily think that all these are in here? Dan's not here yet, so I don't have to, you know, worry too much about the Manzur results. So if I take L effective of 0.19 for Dhamma, or sorry, for xenon, but the quenching factor of 0.08 for iodine, this is what the data look like mapped into S1. I do not know what is in this range of parameter space because xenon 100 has not told us. If instead I take that high value of L effective and a low value of iodine quenching, then the Dhamma modulation is in this range of parameter space, which means that it is only just barely leaking into the left side of that plot. So while I think this is probably not the explanation, I think that probably if you go and you hold down the xenon 100 experimentalist and you get them drunk and you say, tell me, what is in your high energy range, they will probably say, well, it's probably not, you know, a lot of events. Still, I think this emphasizes the point that we're talking about here. If I'm going to give Crest a hard time about not showing their data, then I should be giving xenon 100 a hard time about not showing their data. So xenon 100, here I am giving you a hard time about not showing these data because, at least logically, it is possible that this could be evading your limits as they currently stand. Of course, I don't necessarily need that. Like I said, if you can just somehow manage to get it to scatter off of iodine, like using magnetic couplings or spin-dependent couplings, then you can suppress this. So lastly, let me comment on tungsten for the heavy scattering of Dhamma interpretation. This is what Crest said about inelastic dark matter at Taup. This is the plot they showed. This is the region of parameter space, and this is their exclusion point. How is this phrased? It's about a factor of 4 between this line and there. That is, in their talk, that is phrased as ruled out. In contrast, this is the point of parameter space that they find here, and this is the Zeno limit. That's a factor of 100. That is referred to as considerable tension. So I'm really eager to see what a factor of 1,000 looks like. But anyway, I'm just saying that if they're willing to consider this considerable tension, then I'm willing to consider this as, you know, moderate tension. So let's just play a quick game. I can find out what this line means, right? Inelastic dark matter only scatters in tungsten, and this line corresponds to about 42 events, okay? That doesn't mean they see 42 events because this is a 90% limit. But if I do a Poisson analysis and I say, what does 42 events correspond to? 42 events corresponds to 33 events in the tungsten band. So there's a very reasonable question to ask. Is CREST really pointing us towards light WIMPs, right? You have this M2 point here that everybody's talking about, but you also have this M1 point, which is actually a better fit. So what does that M1 point look like? It's got 2 oxygen events. This is my own calculation, 7.3 calcium events and 19.6 tungsten events. So most of this signal is in tungsten, and they actually say that in their paper. But I can go to M3, which is at the corner of this parameter space, which is still a better fit than M2, right? Because it's in this 67% range. It has 0.8 oxygen events, 3.8 calcium events, and 26.5 tungsten events, right? So this is basically the entirety of what they're claiming in excess would be in tungsten here. If I go all the way to that edge there, then that is 90% out here. You're at 90% tungsten events. So you only have about 2 or 3 events that are not in the tungsten band, which means that if I believe this, and of course I have not seen the limits, but it certainly looks like at the moment you can do a better job explaining the CREST excess by coming up with some signal in the tungsten band than you can by coming up with some signal in the oxygen band. Just by saying, well, oxygen calcium doesn't get me in at 68%, but all tungsten gets me pretty close, right? I'm off by only 4 events. So since they have tungsten, you know that you can explain this with inelastic dark matter and not run into anybody else because none of the other experiments are nearly that heavy. But you might want to try to do something a little bit more fun, like take DAMA and map it into CREST using the same technique we discussed before, but for inelastic dark matter. So these are the DAMA data points. You run into this flattening of things here because of kinematics. Don't worry about it. What do you get? Depending on what your parameter space is, but sort of in this range, you're talking, DAMA would predict somewhere around 15 to 25 events, sort of in the classic ranges of parameters that we look. So rather than saying that these things are in considerable tension, I think that there's actually a reasonable agreement, actually. That's 100% modulation. I'm assuming 100% modulation. So I, like everybody else, am going to have to play the Halo war game where I appeal to some non-Maxwellian blah, blah, blah in order to help amplify my Halo. Yes. So let me conclude. For a long time, we were always saying, wouldn't it be great if we had more data? What this field needs is more data. And now we have more data. And all that has happened is that more data has just made the field a bigger mess. So what do we all say now? Well, hopefully more data will help, at which point you should insert something here about insanity and expecting different results. That said, I don't actually know how to fit all the data right now with light WIMPs. I just don't. Right? I've played a lot of games. I don't. Of course, I don't know what the CREST data are. And I don't really know what the appropriate cogent data are to be fitting right now either. So maybe I could fit the cogent data if I knew precisely what they were. Similarly, I actually don't know what the limits are from xenon 100 at IS1. So I don't really know what limits are on inelastic dark matter from xenon 100 either. So again, something here about needing more data. So I do know that the iodine interpretation of DAMA is still workable if you can evade xenon, either by pushing it out of their range or by using some sort of scattering process that xenon is not sensitive to. And I also think that the inelastic scattering probably can explain the CREST excess. If we just started fresh, we had never heard of cogent, we had never heard of DAMA, and Crest came along and said, aha, look, we have this excess, I'm pretty sure that that set of events can be explained by inelastic scattering without worrying about other limits. But even now, I'm really perplexed. I don't know what the smoking gun result is. If we're in this mess now with all this data, I can't point to a single result in the future that's going to clear everything up. So maybe we just need lots and lots and lots of them, and we'll hope that that will solve the problem. So thanks very much. Necessarily, I don't know that any of them necessarily can be tested of them, because they're all phenomenological models for the most part. As I've described them, they're all phenomenological models. If you had of a large magnetic dipole, the size of a magnetic dipole that you need to explain this, usually those dipoles are sort of weak scale. So if they're weak scale, then that means that you really need some sort of weak scale particles that are coupling to standard models. So those definitely should be able to be produced. Some of the models with light mediators in them, you can get a big cross-section even though your couplings are very small. So techniques like, for instance, that Patty's worked on and Tim Tate has worked on. Has anybody else in this room worked on them? Okay, good. About trying to just use like monojet searches at the LHC get weaker, because what those situations are is you collide things together. You have a high internal, you have a lot of internal energy that then Bremoffs of dark matter, and then a quark goes off into some jet, right? But if that interaction, if that four-point vertex quark-quark, dark matter, for instance, is not a contact interaction but actually softens at high energies, then you can get big direct detection cross-sections but weak collider limits.
I mean, it's the basic fact, right, which is that the LHC relies first and foremost on color production. These models don't necessarily, because they're phenomenological models, don't come in a more complete theory that has colored particles in it. So if you want to produce them, you probably are going to produce colored particles in cascade. So it could well be that if you put this into a broader framework, a SUSY framework, or a Technicolor framework, or anything like that, that you would see that, yes, you can test these. But at this effective level, I don't think.
Can you explain again how KIMS prepares for the problem? So their claim is that their iodine results would exclude.
Yes. So what did I do? So I don't know that they've done this model-independent mapping. I think they've just taken inelastic dark matter models with Maximilian halos and then asked whether they can fit them. But when I take, so I should say that there's this measurement. This is the measurement that was out there prior to Taup. I think they've updated it, but there's not an official result that I can point to yet. This was the quenching factor measurement from their group, summarizing all of them before. And the problem is, if you actually look at this curve here, I was actually using this curve, literally this curve, to do my mapping, and weird things were going on. And I found that what was happening was that as you're moving out here in this curve, that the actual scintillation energy was going down as you moved to higher energy, right? So it's not the quenching factor going down. I mean, the quenching times energy. Like, that means that if you scattered with 140 keV using this curve, I would actually get more light, more signal, than if I scattered at 130, which I don't think is something that should physically really happen. Sure, the quenching factor should go down, but I should not be getting, like, you know, more light at lower energy as this particle sort of cascades down and hits its light. I should get all of that. So I think that it could be that whatever the result is sort of sensitive to whatever quenching factor you use. For this, I just sort of, this is the relevant energy range here, and I just took this and made this mapping. It could be, you know, this is with a quenching factor of 0.07. As I move things around, these things move up or down. So I think in a model-independent way, it's okay right now. I haven't seen them do that mapping. I've just seen them do plots like this. Then, of course, there's a separate question, which is, until I can really see a neutron calibration of this, you know, with, you know, in, you know, as it stands, you know, in situ, can I really see whether this has got a 100% efficiency, which is what they seem to be? Well,
yeah.
They're not assuming 100% efficiency, but they're assuming that they can do this analysis and it's going to accurately capture it. When you have these non-Gaussian tails and you're fitting to Gaussian distributions, I don't know that that's really going to do that for you.
Could you explain again why? Why did you say that it's bad for Crest that they have the energies more above 15 kV? Because you also say that most of the detectors have a threshold around that, they have a high energy threshold. And so in principle, if you believe that background estimates, right, this could all be background, because they are assuming more or less flat backgrounds, so this could all be backgrounds in the high energy region.
Well, I mean, when I say is this bad for Crest, do it. I mean, I'm saying bad in the sense that since they have so much of their thresholds at 15 keV,
yeah,
it looks to me like a lot of their significance is still coming from above 15 keV. Right? So if you're getting significance above 15 keV, those events should unambiguously, just kinematically, be detectable at other experiments. Right? That's what I mean by that. I'm saying that if all their events have been really bunched into some, you know, really rapidly falling thing at low energies, then in a model-independent way, I might not be able to say, know what that should look like at CDMX or at xenon. But since they are claiming events at higher energy, I can say that there is a very significant bound on how much significant rate you can get up there. So really, they should be, if you want the optimal, like, to see whether there's a signal, look between 10 and 15 or below. So, right.
So for this heavy wind and iodine, I think that gives you like a beam in of a few hundred kilometers a second, like 200 to 300 or so somehow. I'm having a really hard time seeing how you can get 100% modulation.
Well, like inelastic dark matter is an example, right? That changes the beam in to something else, right? It makes the beam in much higher.
So you do have to rely on getting the beam in to like 500 to 600 kilometers.
Yeah, but maybe like in some sort of resonance scattering phenomenon, you might still be able to do it possibly if you had some, I don't know, but you can imagine. Well, I don't know. Yeah, you probably have to push it up to higher beam in. In general, right, as you know, if you're really relying on this G of V function, then you really only start getting into the large modulations when you get up to the highest, to the tail.
Then even invoking streams and things, I mean, you're still going to have a background dark matter, a normal sort of close to Maxwellian halo also.
So. Yeah, so you'd be in a situation where you'd want, at that beam in, that structure to dominate the phase space, right?
Yep. When you said you don't know any way to reconcile things, were you including isospin violation as one of your axes?
I believe so, because it depends on how seriously you take the CDMS silicon results.
Germanium?
No, the silicon results.
Huh?
The silicon results. If you take the silicon results seriously, then Crest, for instance, should predict a lot of events there, they're not seeing, they don't have any events. So you actually have to go and you have to say, I don't believe the CDMS silicon results. And this is not CDMS has a threshold of 7 keV, but those limits can be got by taking a 10 keV threshold, so you're moving away from that. So you really have to say, like, and since silicon is light, as you are doing the cancellation, as you try to cancel off xenon, you're canceling off germanium more than you're canceling off silicon, so you actually enhance the signal of silicon relative to what it was in the cases that I was talking about. So, I don't think that is my point.
But in the latter part of your talk, you were not worrying about the low mass wimps, and then you.
I had basically given up the iodine scattering part of the talk. I basically, at that point, I gave up on trying to explain the cogent result.
Right.
Focusing on Dhamma, I think you can explain Dhamma and Crest with problems with xenon that maybe are evadable if you have some sort of non-additional coupling, like a dipole or something like that. But I don't know how to do cogent in that situation at the moment. But maybe when we have more data, but the data have changed, so it might actually be easier to fit them now. I don't know.
I've been asked a quick question.
I was going to ask about directional experiments with directional sensitivity. Is there anything coming online, and would it help, or is it will just sort of muddy the water?
If it's really, most directional experiments have very, very high thresholds, because to get a path length that you can track it out, you need to have a pretty high recoil energy. So, in terms of like, if you're interested in probing the light WIMP region of parameter space, that's going to be probably not super helpful.
Doug and his student Tong Yan had an interesting paper about turning xenon 100 into a direct detection or a directional experiment, but I will let him tell you about that.
I'm not going to.
No, but offline.
Well, I guess we better move on and let's go.